This week, Michael and I will have a discussion on leadership, innovation, and startup success, and maybe some startup failure, too. A bunch of articles. We're going to talk about successful entrepreneurs battling from idea to launch, why the future will be won by the scientist, and in the second segment, we'll talk about startup security news. We've got a lot of updates. Excuse me. SailPoint, WatchGuard, Forescout, Synopsys, and more on this episode of Startup Security Weekly.
This is Security Weekly, for security professionals by security professionals. Broadcasting live from G-Unit Studios in Rhode Island, it's the show about security startups, how to secure your startup, and advice for security startups. It's Startup Security Weekly. I need it from the top. Brought to you by, make sure your team is prepared to fight off the latest cybersecurity threat. IT Pro TV is the resource to keep you and your IT team skills up to date. You can stream IT Pro TV's courses live and on demand worldwide, so there's no need to send staff to off-site training. Their team solution provides access to a supervisor portal for full control over your team's training schedule and group analytics. Go to itpro.tv/startup security and use the code SS30 to try it free for 7 days and receive 30% off your monthly membership for the lifetime of your active subscription. To learn more about IT Pro TV's team solution, sign up for a free demo of their supervisor portal. Do you have a website, an external presence, employees, an office? Any of these things can be compromised and attacked. How are you defending these assets? Have you penetration tested these public assets? Start 2017 by taking a proactive approach to securing your vulnerable areas. Black Hills Information Security has been helping companies find their weaknesses since 2008. Email consulting@blackhillsinfosec.com and see how they can help you sleep better at night. Are you looking for a career where you can make a real difference? Accenture Security is looking for passionate, creative minds to tackle some of the biggest security threats facing us today. Innovative thinkers who want to outmaneuver cyber criminals. They're hiring specialists across the spectrum, from security strategy to cyber defense, digital identity, and application security, helping to deliver holistic solutions. If you want to use next-generation technologies and global resources to change the future of security, visit Accenture.com/security careers.
Welcome, everyone, to Startup Security Weekly. I'm your host, Paul Assadorian, for November 3rd, 2017. This is episode 61, and I would like to introduce on the lines via Skype the sand hobo himself, Mr. Michael Santarcangelo. Michael, how are you today?
I am fantastic. I love the ring of that. That's so much better. Beach bum is probably more accurate, but sand hobo just sounds better. Hobo. I like it, and I'm good. I'm excited.
You love it, and you want some more of it. No? Okay, maybe not.
Too well. No. You got it. You got me all figured out. I can't even hide it anymore.
Michael, are you tired of doing file analysis by hand?
Yeah. Yeah. It's kind of obvious, right?
Yeah. I mean, we all are. You should register for our webcast coming up with Stealth Bits. Dr. Doug White will talk about file system forensics, which is a unique opportunity. Doug's been doing it since the beginning of time on those 9-inch floppies that we talked about on a Paul Security Weekly show. and Jonathan Sander, who you know very well, will also be on that webcast talking about systems analysis and automation. You should definitely tune in and check out just to be there to hear. I don't really need to say anything more other than Dr. Doug White and Jonathan Sander. Like, I'm just going to sit back and watch the fireworks spectacular for that webcast, dude.
I agree. I'm on the website right now signing up.
There you go. Securityweekly.com/stealthbits. Awesome. All right. Well, let's jump right into it, Michael. You and I haven't talked in a while. Just a shame. I was...
It is.
What happened? What was last week? I don't remember. It's all a blur.
I had a workshop. A workshop last week.
You had a workshop, and then...
And we tried to find a guest host, and I guess I'm irreplaceable or something?
We were working on the studio last week, so we decided to... canceled a bunch of shows because we needed to rip apart the studio. There was some pretty major construction going on in here. which will be more next week too. But we got it to a point where we can actually record shows now, which is good, which is awesome.
That's awesome.
And then
it is. That's exciting stuff.
It is. So what's going on in the world of leadership, innovation, and startup success, Michael?
All right, we're gonna cover the gamut. And as usual, as we go through some of these pieces, I want to point out a couple things for people to think about each of these different situations. I've been out. We'll talk about this at the end of the program, but the workshops, Paul, are working, right? That sounds inelegant to say it that way. But when we start looking at solving problems and bringing stuff together, I'm really encouraged with the teams and the leaders that I've been working with, because a lot of the stuff that we talk about for startups, they need to know too. They need to look at it. They need to consider stuff the same way. And part of the reason for that is because when you're operating in a startup-like mode, so you're starting up a new team, you've got to justify pretty much everything. You've got to justify your hires. You've got to make sure people are focusing on the right stuff. So there's this cool concept called contribution margin. It's a Harvard Business Review article, and it's a good – I mean, I go to their stuff from time to time. It's one of the subscriptions that I have, so I thoroughly enjoy it. But here's the basic idea. If you ask somebody, hey, how are you doing? What's your profitability? People will – a lot of times they'll look at it. In fact, one of the things we'll talk about in our updates today is one of the companies isn't even yet profitable. They had their IPO. They've done very well, and they're really hoping that maybe next year is the year that they become profitable. So a lot of times what we'll do is we'll take a look at profit margin, and that basically says, okay, here's my total amount of sales, here's my total amount of cost, here's the money that's left over, look at us, didn't we do a good job? And by the way, if you're just trying to check the health of the company, not a bad way to look at it. When you look at contribution margin, what you're looking at now is how much does each of the products or services that we offer contribute to that piece, right? Hence, it's contribution. Now, as she points out in this article, you can do it a couple different ways, but basically what it does is you take the contribution margin, and that's the revenue that you create from that product or that service, that feature, whatever, and then less whatever the variable costs are. Now, I want to point something out relative to that. When we talk a lot, and you'll hear me just say it, unit economics, this is what I'm talking about. So when we talk about getting your unit economics right, figuring out your delivery model. And again, I'm going to point out this matters even if you're not a startup today, because if you're offering services, one of the things that we're seeing more and more in the security space is the realization that security teams have to influence without direct authority. I've even talked to a couple teams in,
I like
in the
that.
Fortune 500.
I like that. Influence that, without direct authority. I like that a lot.
I'll tell you what, it's going to be the lead on my homepage, because it's what keeps coming up in all of these teams. And Paul, when we sit down, we did a great exercise in the workshop on Friday, and we said, okay, well, hold on though. We have a policy, so we should have authority, right? We ran through it. Here's the bottom line. Yeah, no, not really. And I've talked to huge financial companies where security is actually really important. And you know what? Their big challenge? We still need to influence without authority. Like we need to take a different way of being able to do it. If you want to go influence without authority, that means you're going to be thinking about the services that you're offering to the teams around the organization, which then means you've got a bunch of internal consumers. You can't do things that drive your team into the ground. So when we talk about the unit economics, what we're talking about is how much does it take you, how much does it cost to make something, and how much does it cost to deliver something? A lot of times we're quick to discount those costs. So, you know, you asked me about, you know, doing manual file analysis. It's mind-numbing. I can't do that. I can't add enough bodies to it. So of course we should go check out what Jonathan and Dr. Doug are going to show us. But you know, as you go through this, then your contribution margin says here's how much money I made from it, and here's what the variable costs were that contributed to it, and that's it. So you can start it pretty easy, because you can take a look at a fixed cost, right? Those are the things that, like, I already had the computer and I paid for the internet and I've got all these overhead costs, and then there's the variable costs. To deliver that service, does it take any time from somebody? Do you have to walk them through a setup? Is there an on-ramp? And then as you start taking a look of those things, it starts to help you understand what the contribution margin is. Now, why does that matter? Well, what that does now is it helps me figure out things like my fixed versus my variable costs. And so here, I'll give you an example. And this is why I think this matters, not just if you're a startup. So this is a quote. It's likely that a division leader at GE is managing a portfolio of 70-plus products and has to constantly recalculate where to allocate resources. As a division head, if I have to cut, I'm going to cut products that have the lowest contribution margin so I can focus resources on growing the business and increasing profit. I can hear it right now. But Michael, we're in security. We're not about profit. Yeah, I know. I get it. And it's like when a nonprofit says, we're nonprofit. Yes, you still have to make money to put the lights on. If you're in security today, you still got to solve the problems. You've got to increase value. You've got to show people that it matters. So these are the things that matter. That's
what all. I was doing a webcast yesterday with Signal Sciences, and Zane was talking. I don't know if it was on air or off air, but it was talking about the way that you actually deploy. I think it was off air. It was talking about deployment for their solution. And I was like, well, what if I were to, like, pretend I'm a customer, right? I want to put it inside my application so I can do web application security monitoring, or really web application monitoring via Signal Sciences. And we got through the technical details, and I was like, oh, so it literally takes me 4 minutes, right? Because that's really how long that would take me. I know exactly how long that would take me. It was like 4 minutes. He's like, yeah, pretty much. He's like, we don't even tell people like minutes anymore because they don't believe us until they do it. And they're like, wow, that took minutes. I'm like, no, dude, what you described would literally take me minutes. So the barrier to entry is extremely low for customers. And that, and I think that's speaking to your contribution margin, right? Is that's
absolutely
part of the cost.
Yeah, so here,
if I have to spend hours on the phone with Zane or whoever the vendor is, and go through a difficult process, that just has to be factored into a cost. I like it.
That's right. And it gets factored on both sides. So if you're the vendor, you've got to say, okay, how much time do I need to walk somebody through this? So, you know, where Signal Sciences has figured it out, and they said, look, you don't need us. We've got the wizard or whatever figured out. You can be up and running literally in minutes. That's a huge point for them. And when we get to value proposition and we really start not only looking at value, but more specifically here, impact, that's a huge multiplier in the positive column. So that's awesome. And yeah, you got to look at it, because as a vendor, if that means, right, the new phrase is customer success people. If you have to ramp up your customer success team because they've got to handhold and walk everybody through it, that's not necessarily a bad thing.
Right.
All it is a thing. It just means you need to pay attention to it, be aware
cost,
of it.
Right.
Yeah. But if you can figure out how you can reduce those costs, then you get a higher contribution margin. And that's a good thing. So a lot of times what I'll look at, and I want to be careful now because this concept of a scorecard pops up in security a lot more. And we talked about security scorecard with their latest funding round and such. That's not what I'm talking about. But what I said to a lot of security leaders is, do you have a scorecard? Like, how many products? I mean, Paul, what you and I have talked to a number of people. They say on average, the security leader today is managing between 50 and 70 different relationships.
Mm-hmm.
We've talked about that in the SOC, the average analyst is working with 37 different panels or screens in order just to do an assessment. Okay, so I think conservatively, we probably got 40 to 50 different products in our environment. Which ones are getting you the best lift for the services you're trying to offer, and which ones are just not cutting it? And when you look at me and go, I don't know, right, guys, this is, you know, I don't mean to be too blunt, but if you then say to me, the business doesn't take us seriously, the executives aren't really paying attention, nobody's listening, okay, well, how many things are you managing? What are your better performers and why? What are the ones you might cut and why? And what do you need to do next and why? You can't answer any of those questions? All right, well, then I don't mean to be a jerk, but I can tell you why you're not getting stuff figured out.
I want to point out an area, in a category within information security solutions that I think can really help with this, Michael. And I know we have a little extra time today because we don't have a guest, so I want to get your take on it. There are companies like Grimm and Safe Breach and a couple of others. And really what I'm finding is, after, you know, working with Grimm and their awesome team over there, is I'm starting to understand the market better in that they make security solutions that evaluate your existing security solutions. And sometimes they'll present themselves as like, we're an automated pen test, we're automated malware distribution. I believe where their real value is, I've got 37 products in my environment. I need to evaluate the effectiveness of them. Sure, penetration testing, great exercise. Even if you have do it more often, or if you have your own internal pen test team, they can only get so far. But if you've got an automated little monkey that's running around your environment, it's kind of how I think of it, and evaluating the effectiveness of you, and giving you a good, if the reporting is good, then it can give me a scorecard, as you're talking about, and say, you know, here are the deficiencies in in your various systems. When your manager in your scenario comes to you, Michael, and says, you know, like, how are we doing? Like, how are we doing defending against evil, bad people is one thing, but how our effect, what is the effectiveness of our security solutions are two different questions. And I like the category that allows organizations to evaluate what they have.
Yep. Yep. I think that people that are able to do that, I think they have a tough story to tell, because a lot of folks are going to sit there and say, well, but why do I need to do that? Right. A lot of what we do in security today is dogmatic. Well, I bought this. Why? Because we always have it. Okay. So you need to have it. Yeah, Michael, it's a firewall. We totally need to have it. Okay. Right. What would happen if you didn't have it? Bad things would happen. Okay. But everything else you have has a firewall built into it. Do you really need it? By the way, folks, I'm not advocating go rip out all the firewalls. All I'm saying is, have you asked the question? Mm-hmm. Like, what if, right? And this is where we look at things like zero-based budgeting and everything else. I think that the way that security has spiraled, and it's been good for us. I mean, I've built a career on it. Paul, you and I have been doing this long enough. In the mid-90s, late-90s, if you got into security, you literally had somebody sit you down and counsel you about the career mistake you're about to make, mm-hmm. and how, you know, you needed to go into networking or desktop support or whatever else, because that's where the real opportunities were. Okay. You know, back then, if you got into security, you know, you either hit your head a lot as a kid, or, you know, there was something about us that just – we saw the world a little different, and that's exciting. And so that's created all these really cool opportunities. A lot of what we did, it was tough to explain. It was hard to make sense, but we knew that if we did it, it worked really well. There's a lot of medicine that works that way. Can't tell you exactly why it works, but I can tell you that it works. Mm-hmm. Security, to a certain extent, has functioned that way, but it doesn't have to. And we're getting to a place now where if you can tell me which of these things are contributing to our success as a team versus the things that aren't, that's really good. Now, some of you are probably saying, so can I do this for my people? I'm going to answer that really carefully. Yes, no. Yeah, I mean, of course you can. Should you? It's called a performance review. I'd be a little bit more careful with that. Mm-hmm. But let's talk about sales for a second. I really liked this piece of advice, and I kind of terrified it. This is why I put it in there. How do you feel about like door-to-door selling? Or how about if I give you a job as a telemarketer? You got to make outbound calls all day. How does that feel?
Terrifying, right? In reading this article, I would adopt the approach that he recommends in the article. And I think it's towards the end where he talks about when there's a sales crunch. So if you give me a telemarketing job or sales job and I got to meet a quota, that what a lot of people do in crunch time where I got to meet my numbers is they get hyper-focused on the hot leads and try and close those deals. Yep. And what he's recommending this article is no, just talk to more people. Talk to more people and get your if your sales messaging is good, your product is good, talking to more people is going to work for you, right? And I feel like, the organizations that struggle maybe don't have a good sales process, good messaging, or maybe not a good product. And when you talk to more people, I feel like you can find that person that's going to be a much quicker sales cycle because you're solving their immediate problem where someone else, exactly. Yeah, you may be further along down the path, but man, you got a longer way to go to convince them. And that might be worth it in the long run, but if you're looking to meet numbers, increase sales, talk to more people. And I can see we do that a lot here at Security Weekly. I mean, I try and talk to as many vendors as I can. And, you know, we have this sales criteria that, like, you can't be a vendor that all of my friends in the security community have had bad experiences with, or even a large majority, right? Like you have to have products that actually solve people's problems, as I've heard some people, you know, phrase it. And so we, just by that nature, talk to more, as many people as we can. And it turns out that's a pretty good sales strategy as well. So I kind of fell into that by accident, Michael, but I think it's sound.
I've seen the difference myself. Here's something that really struck me when I took a look at this. And I've been thinking about it I've got four kids, and we always joke we got two sets, the bigs and the littles. And it's been kind of an interesting week for us because we've got one in high school, and so we're talking about already like graduation plans and what do the next couple of years look like. And then we have one in kindergarten and one not yet in school, and then, you know, one in middle school. So we got three kids, three different schools. And it's just kind of interesting, like when you look at those stages of life. Here's the thing then that kind of matters. A lot of people then say, well, I should go get a job. And I've come to realize that I'm going to encourage my children to go learn how to sell and go learn how to sell hard stuff. So what this says is, look, this guy that they're talking about, he sold books, went door to door selling books. You know, it's kind of like going door to door and selling Kirby vacuums, or going door to door and selling any number of other types of things. Now, I don't necessarily mean that I want my kids to, you know, get involved in one of these multi-level marketing things. I have no problems with them, and it's a good side hustle. But what I'm taking a look at is, can you go establish rapport with somebody? Can you find somebody? Can you interrupt them? And can you connect with them? Can you impart value to them? I mean, if you think about a lot of what we do in Straight Talk, and if in fact, I'm going to go back a step further. Let's go take a look at a lot of the challenges that we face in security today, because I got to tell you, and my excitement's going to keep coming through, and I will not apologize for it. I've spent 10 or so years trying to figure out my place in security. And I've bounced around to a bunch of different stuff. In the last 3 or 4 years, it was looking like Straight Talk. And I've been talking about this workshop and putting together for a while. Paul, the dots are coming together, and it's so exciting. But now I'm getting to work with teams that are at this point. You know what they want? They want to go figure out how to connect with people, because that's what it's going to take to be successful. Mm-hmm. They want to figure out how to collaborate better so that they're getting a complete picture. They're understanding what's up. They're making better decisions faster. And, of course, when you start doing those things, you can get your influence without direct authority and all that type of stuff that you're looking at. Well, you know what you have to do when you're doing door-to-door sales and you're doing things that are a little bit more complex? You got to meet people where they're at. You got to learn how to build a connection with them quickly. You've got to bring them into the sale and collaborate with them about their current situation and how you can elevate their situation into their better tomorrow. And are you going to close most of the deals? No, you're going to have a lot of doors slammed in your face and a lot of people telling you no. But what I've learned in life is that if you can communicate and you can meet people and you can believe in the value that you bring them so much that you're willing to knock on the door and say, hi, do you have a minute? Which, by the way, is probably not going to keep the door open. So you got to come up with a better way. I mean, think about all those lessons. And is it terrifying? I think it's terrifying. And I think that's why it's awesome. And then what he learned in this is what you were just talking about, which is there's a quality of the prospect. There's the quality of the presentation that you give and the way that you think about it. And there's the quality of the effort. And I think you're right. A lot of people, they get panicked at the end. And by the way, I think some of that too is on the companies, because we put all that pressure. I got to make the quarterly numbers. I got to show it. I'm always fascinated when I talk to a company that wants to extol me, we've had 16 complete quarters of growth, blah, blah. Yeah. And? As you said, are you solving problems? Do people like you? Are you contributing value? Like, good for you for growth. I don't know what that means. I mean, I do. I know I'm being a little bit of a jerk about it. But so anyway, I think this is useful. And he's right. When you're in a slump, go see more people. You know, go talk to more people and see where your messaging resonates. And then listen. I would say, too, when you're talking, listen. Listen to what they're really telling you and start to draw those connections, and you'll find a couple things happen. You'll get your good short-term sales, but you'll also build that longer-term stuff. So for me, it's always about the quality touches. And as you've pointed out, when I go in and I work with startups and I look at their sales team or I look at their messaging, typically when they're struggling, it's really unfocused. And this is something you and I have talked about, but I'll point it out here. When you're that small team, by the way, this will work too if you're a security team. There's a handful of you, 4 or 5, maybe up to 10 people. You're going to move pretty fast. Because that's a small enough group, you can get together on a regular basis. You're going to go through a bunch of those battles together. You're going to learn the knowledge that you share is very tribal. It's easy to do. Once you start growing, everybody's going to put their own stamp on it. They're going to miss out on a lot of that nuance. If you're in a vendor, that's when the sales cycle goes from 3 months to 6 months to 12 months or longer. What's happening? They don't know what you're talking about. You didn't build up that relationship. You're not focusing on the right quality of the prospect. You're not being as discerning as you used to be. And the messaging is just completely confusing. And we seem to have this misguided belief that, well, it's confusing, but they'll figure it out. No, they won't. They're busy. This is why we always talk about, when you answer for me, what problem are you trying to solve? You need to isolate that and you've got to elevate that. That's the only way my brain is going to lock onto that. But if you make me work too hard, my evaluation will just be, yeah, that's not my problem. Move on. Could be totally my problem. You could be the solution I have been begging for. But I'm not necessarily going to go out of my way to look for it. So I like this. I like this idea of really learning the hustle. And I think there's a lot of folks, and I've seen and talked to a bunch of people, Paul, over the last year or two, that thought selling was easy till they had to do it themselves and like really had to do it because that's how they put food on the table. And suddenly you figure out, oh, this isn't what it seemed like. There's more to this. And that's, by the way, and somebody asked the other day, will I put together a list of the books that I keep talking about on the show with a quick summary of each? Mm-hmm. And I'm going to say yes, but things are a little hectic still for a couple more weeks. So yes, I will put that, Paul, we'll make it available here.
Yeah.
I'll stick it up on my website as well. And then one of the other things I'm going to start doing, and I'm not sure where I'm going to offer it or how I'm going to do it, but it occurred to me that some of them I can even connect to things we talk about on Startup and yeah. some things in the enterprise and some things that I can do relative to Straight Talk. So yeah. I like these books because I like these books. So
I like this next article too, and I think it segues from the previous article very, very nicely. It's like stuff, if you read that first article, then read this one. They give you some tips. The three questions that they ask in here, Michael, I love. It's just they're awesome.
Well, and you obviously know that I love asking questions. Yeah, mm-hmm. this is another one. So again, it's another one I pulled out of the Harvard Business Review, and I think this is in this issue. I actually didn't read this issue yet, but so it's a short guide to strategy for entrepreneurs. Yes, it's also a great guide to strategy if you're running a security team today. And you're right. Here's the three questions that they ask, and they're looking at value creation, value delivery, and value capture. When I do the workshop, one of the things we talk about, Paul, is the imperative of value or the value imperative. It all starts with value. Straight Talk starts with value. Everything starts with value. If you're not adding value, if you're not receiving value, stop doing it. And again, somebody right there is going, Michael, it's regulatory. I have to do it. No, every regulation has the ability to not do the regulation. You might pay a penalty for it. You might be going out of business if you don't comply with it. Okay, well then, that doesn't mean you had to do it and there was no value in it. The value in complying with it is you remain a going concern. All right, here's their three questions. It's really kind of funny because they added a bunch of more in here. All right, so who are you serving? Fine. By the way, that is important. It doesn't always have to be the first question you ask. I'll tell you why in a second. What are you offering? How are you able to deliver it? And why won't it be copied? All right, let me go with two quick parts here. I think the first thing to do is figure out what you're offering and how you're able to deliver it. A lot of times I've worked with folks in an ideal setting. Yes, I solve this problem for this group of people. I can tell you with my own experience, Paul, it started out looking at, do I have a play with startups? Yep. Turns out, and I'm thoroughly enjoying this, higher education security teams and the workshops, they're fantastic. I love their approaches. They've got a real need to influence without authority. I'm thoroughly enjoying that. And if you had asked me 6 months ago if that would be a potential, in fact, maybe even my best client, my ideal client type, I wouldn't have thought about it. But then also enterprises, large enterprise. I've always been a Fortune 500 guy, and those folks have said, hey, you know what? We need some of that. So here's the thing. If you figure out what you're offering first, and you kind of have a notional idea, right? I mean, I knew it was security leaders. I knew it was security leaders with teams of a certain size trying to accomplish certain outcomes. So how are you able to deliver? That took me a couple iterations as well, but I've got that kind of figured out. But the why won't it be copied? Here's what I kind of look at too. What if it is? Like, my point on this is don't lose too much sleep over that. Now, granted, if you're doing a product or you're offering some sort of an app and you're worried about somebody in the app store knocking it off or whatever else, probably a more valid question. But if you're just talking about your hustle because you're consulting or because you're creating training on something or because you're writing a book, yeah, do it. Just do it. Don't lose too much sleep over why it won't be copied. I've always been a fan of Marshall Goldsmith. People always ask me who I like for leadership. Marshall Goldsmith, love his stuff. Thoroughly, absolutely love his stuff. And one of his practices is he just gives it away. Now, mind you, it's rumored that his fees to coach Fortune 500 like CEOs are substantial and only gets paid, as I understand it, and I have not yet met the man, but as I understand it, he only gets paid, Paul, if he gets you the results that you talked about as evaluated by like your board or the other executive team. So basically, now if you wanted to throw, you know, mid six figures on the table for me and say, hey, if I get these results at the end of the year, I'll pay you. Okay, cool. Right? And he's been doing it for a long time. He's really successful. But if you ever watch any of his speeches, he says, go to my website. Here's a library. Here's this, this, and this. If you want this, send me an email. I'll send it back to you. Now, obviously, it's not him sending it to you, I don't think. He's very generous with this stuff. And somebody asked him one time, aren't you afraid somebody's going to take your stuff? And he said, what, and become better leaders? Right. Yeah, I'm good with that. Mm-hmm. And you know what? People still buy their books. We had the pleasure of interviewing Cory Doctorow back on Security Weekly. And what did he learn when he gave away his book absolutely for free? He still got a publishing deal, still got an advance. People still buy the book. Mm-hmm. Right. Should you worry about somebody else capturing some of your value? Yes. But don't lose sleep over it. So my take, I'm curious yours. Focus on what you're offering. Focus on how you're going to deliver it. Make sure you've got an audience that needs it. And then if you're doing something that where someone stealing it would take the rug out from underneath you, yes, focus on it. If not, move on. Go create value. Do good things for good people, and build a business.
Yeah.
What's your take on that?
I think competitive advantage is kind of interesting because there's two aspects to it. You know, when I look at my businesses, I try and solve the problem differently. I'm trying to explain it without using specific examples. In other words, when we talk about advertising for companies, I try and explain why they should advertise on our network versus doing some other marketing activities. Now, that's not direct competition with us, right? But it's really a value pitch, so you're going to get a lot of value out of this. And oh, by the way, in your other activities, this is where you turn competitive advantage on its head. Oh, by the way, the other stuff that you're doing, we're going to enhance that as well. You're going to get a better return. And security solutions should do the same thing. Like, we're going to get the solution. We're going to solve the problem better. We're going to help you overcome the shortcomings with maybe some of the other of the 36 solutions that you have. And, oh, by the way, we're going to strengthen your return on investment for your other security investments to put it in a security context. And I think once you have that, that's one aspect. Now, then the other aspect of competition are there people that do exactly what you do, and you just have to, stick to your value points and your point of view on the problem, and move forward. Like Michael said, don't get too caught up with competitive analysis.
Well, and Paul, you already gave part of this answer before too. You're not going to be a fit for everybody. Everybody's not going to be a fit for you.
Right.
So if somebody else does something similar, it doesn't mean that they're naturally a competitor. It doesn't mean that you can't be friendly with them. It doesn't mean any number of things. It just means, okay, cool. And I've always been impressed by the folks, right? Like, talent recognizes talent. Like, somebody's like, or performers recognize performers. It's like, cool, I do it different, but I like what I see what you did there. I respect that. I think that's kind of awesome. And I think we're better for that as an industry. I think we're better for that in the community. Now, a lot of folks are trying to put together different ideas. And so how do you battle from your idea to your launch and to survive? We think it's really inventing is easy. I think if you watch this show, you probably know it's not. Did you ever watch it? You and I always trade off shows, and I have not yet watched Halt and Catch Fire, but there was one for a while on CNBC called Million Dollar Inventor. And it was taking people with their ideas from their inventions. They'd get partnered up with a coach, and then they would take them through a redesign phase and a prototyping phase, and they would sit them down and pitch them with investors. I loved it. As you can imagine, I talked out loud to the TV quite a bit while watching it, but I liked it. And so the thing that's interesting is when you look at it is people go, oh, well, I've got the idea. Once I've got it, I sketched it out. I mean, it's good, right? I mean, people are going to jump on it. And the short answer is no. So what happened here, and it's a neat story of a person with special forces, a background in securing different things. That's all cool. Here's what really matters, though. So four lessons. Hold off on your licensing deals. By the way, so I'm going to point this one out because this one I really liked a lot. Basically what he said was, wait till your product's established. Wait till you're making money on it. Wait till you can go show people how it's valuable. And then your licensing deals get better. Yes, same thing with partnerships, same thing with everything else. If you go focus on really solving the problem and you've got your stuff together, you know what your deals are going to be, you know how everything's going to work out, and you've got that track record, then that's the difference. I mean, some of the authors that they get, they're on their seventh or eighth bestseller, they get bigger advances, they get bigger royalties, they get bigger everything. Why? Because they're proven. Go prove. Give somebody that proof. Take some of that risk away. You're going to get a better licensing deal, and you're going to get more opportunities in those deals. I like that. The other thing that I thought mattered here too, I mean, pacing yourself is always important, whether you're drinking booze or you're working on anything. But, and he talks about choosing your partners wisely, but it's also about losing focus. And I think a lot of it comes back to that. Have your focus. Validate it from time to time. Check it. Don't be afraid to evolve it. We use that word pivot too much. Don't be afraid to evolve it as you're tinkering and figure out that product market fit, and stay on it. It's going to take a little bit of time, but if you can get it figured out by listening to the right people, I think you'd do better off. But the point is, you've got an idea? Awesome. All right. Now your journey's about to begin. Strap in.
In holding off on licensing, I always think of Kevin on Shark Tank because he always jumps right in with the – the licensing deal.
That's how he made his money, by the way. He's impressive. Yeah. I know he loves playing the bad guy, but I thoroughly enjoy him. And in the new season, as Sir Richard Branson, and a few others, and I've watched a couple of them, and I enjoy it. When they go for the marathons, it's too long. I don't need the drama. I just want to see the business, see how it works.
Yeah, it did get a little drama-like, but I agree with you with Kevin. I think he just plays the bad guy just for the role on TV. I actually think they did like a behind-the-scenes with Kevin kind of thing and told a little more of a story, and I actually think he's a really nice guy, so... Is my assessment.
Really nice. He's really, really intelligent. I'd work with him in a heartbeat. I think Mark Cuban's his energy is fantastic. These are people I'd love to meet and work with. Mm-hmm. All right, scientist CEO. So here's the basic idea. I'm kind of curious your take on this. What they're looking at is they think that the challenges in a lot of places, in startups and other things in particular, are that CEOs today don't necessarily understand science. They don't understand science. I would argue conveniently they don't understand cybersecurity. They don't understand a lot of different things. And so the way that we solve that is we start taking people who have that expertise and have this expertise, and we start blending them together. In other words, the CEOs of the future are going to be the security researchers, the scientists. For what it's worth, I'm on board with this completely. I've been telling people consistently for the last 3 or 4 years that if you've got a security background today and you aspire to something other than just being a security leader, a CISO or otherwise, and I have, if you tell me that's your end goal, that's awesome too. But if you said, well, I want to be a CIO one day or I want to be a CEO one day, I promise you, the amount of attention that security is getting, if you can develop all these other things that we're talking about in terms of your ability to lead and to communicate and to understand the business side of stuff, I think you've really poised yourself well for those positions. And that's essentially what this is saying. It's saying, look, if you want to be good at these things and you want to understand how to run a startup that does research or a startup that does security, you kind of got to understand those fields a little bit. Now, I'm going to offer a quick counter to this because we see this a lot of times in security where someone say, well, the only way you can be a CISO is if you understand security. Understand security is a really wide path. So what I would say is you can give me somebody who's a competent, capable leader with proven demonstrated skills and put them in charge of a top performing team, and they can learn what they need to know about security on the job. I have 100% confidence in that. Do I see it a lot? No. But I have confidence in it. And it's the same thing here. Can you take somebody who doesn't have any natural interest in being a leader, being a CEO, being executive? Because you and I ask a lot of the folks that are CEOs of the startups, what's it like now that you made the transition? And a few of them, even off air, have been pretty blunt. It is not what they expected. It's a grind. It took them out of a lot of the stuff that they loved. It was harder than they expected. But I still think we're going to see more of this. And I think it's good. I think this is a good trend. And that's why I put it in there. So if you're in security today and you're saying, well, am I cut out to be a CEO? Yes. Am I cut out to be a CEO of my own company? Absolutely. Can I be the CEO of somebody else's? Yes. Can I be the CEO of GE? Probably not. But, you know, maybe. I mean, you know, prove me wrong. It's ML had a really tenuous career, and they got a new guy, and I'm forgetting his name. I got to look him up. But I'm impressed with what I'm seeing out of GE right now. By the way, just as an aside, because we've talked about him. If you remember, Paul, we did when he came on board, he said, all right, here's the three things and the only three things. Well, he's spinning off a big portion of their business now. Like, he basically said, look, this isn't our core focus. We're not really the best at it. And it's really kind of, you know, and when I say spinning off, I mean like, you know, $20, $30, $40 billion worth of spinoff. That's bold strategy. I really dig it. I like it. So I don't know. What are your thoughts? I mean, you've been on a lot of the different sides of this, and you've worked in academia. You've worked in on the research side of stuff. You've been on the marketing side of stuff. I think that really qualifies you to be more effective as a CEO of the organizations that you're part of. Have you found that those experiences have contributed to you? And do you think that that sets the stage for other people?
No, I do. But I also think that you know, it's a team effort, and I kind of like your, when you talked about that TV show, the coaching idea. You know, we can take scientists and have them have a coach, or maybe there's a scientist that has a business partner that plays the CEO role. So I think defining roles early on and, you know, also having a coach is really important to taking your idea to the next level.
All right. So on that coaching, perfect segue. This is kind of like the bonus, right? I always try to choose 5 articles. So this one, I loved it. And this is why I threw it in. So here's the headline. These top tech companies are hiring first, training later. This is something I think we need to adopt in security, and I think we need to adopt it sooner rather than later. Now, I am happy myself now to invite the controversy. I don't think we have a shortage. I cringe every time I see it, and it ranges anywhere from a couple hundred thousand now to 2 million to 3 million to by 2020, the world is going to die because we don't have enough security people or something. People always get irritated with me when I point that out because they say, well, they can't find somebody. And as I've pointed out consistently, every time this happens, just because you have a problem hiring, and I know someone, we're going to get the hate mail, you sent it to me. Just because you have a problem hiring somebody doesn't mean that we have a broad systemic problem. Did you have a clear understanding of who you were hiring? And did you have a value proposition for the role? Did that person present you with a value proposition? Do you understand the hiring process? Does everybody involved in it understand it properly? And typically, once I dig into these, anybody who's got a real challenge, I've dug into it, and it turns out, we didn't have any of those. But do I then flip it around and say, is there a bigger need for this? Yes. I had the privilege this week of hosting Hack Naked News, and thankfully saw the intro ahead of time, Paul, so I had clothes on, so it was good. Mm-hmm. But one of the things we talked about is extending the Peace Corps mission to include cybersecurity in particular. I think that's intriguing. I'd like to learn more about it, but I think that's intriguing. So here's the point for this one. Hire smart people. Hire good people. Train them into the position. Train them in. And there's a couple different ways to do it. I don't remember if it's in this article in particular or if it's somebody else's. I feel like Buffer has done a lot of stuff to be super transparent, and I'm really impressed with it. And I think so this is not in this article, I think, but Buffer basically said what we used to do is welcome people on board and they have like a 6-month trial process. And if they don't complete the 6 months, like there's a buy off, like we'll give them money. So if they get to like, you know, week 6 and they're like, screw this, this isn't for me. Okay, cool. Here's your check, you know, and thank you and good luck. Zappos used to, or probably still does, some of the same things, like get through the training. And if you decide it's not for me, we'll pay you. Thank you for your time and head out the door.
Right.
What Buffer found, Paul, was that put too much pressure on the wrong things and the wrong people in the wrong way. And so what they do now is you're a full member of the team from day one. Your benefits are all vested. Like everything's good to go. And then they onboard you for 90 days or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. So instead of saying it's a competition, we hope you're still here, we're here to make sure you kick ass.
Right.
That's what this is talking about. So if you think about it, one of the interesting things that I always found was people would say, well, you know, the answer to the shortage, Michael, is we need universities and technical schools, right? What we used to call community colleges to step up and pick up the slack. By the way, we've largely seen that. Then you go to the hiring managers and you say, well, how's that working? And they go, well, you know, they're book smart, but they didn't have any practical experience. Mm-hmm. So, like, I love what you did with Prof Hack Con and invite students out, invite the community out, right? So make it part industry meets community. Let's meet the students where they are. Let's get them excited. I'm going to add a dimension. Let's make sure their families understand what's going on. Let's bring everybody into it. And then, you know, you've got this potential now to mentor and work with people for a period of 2 to 4, 5, 6 years. And then by the time it's ready to hire them, you know who they are. You know what they're capable of. Great. Well, it's kind of what they're saying here. Do you have a program, if you could go find somebody with the right aptitude, skill set, interest, attitude, that you could run them through a training program? And at the end of that training program, they had the skill set you needed, indoctrinated into your methods and systems of doing stuff, and could crush it. And all I'm going to say real quick, because I'm curious your thoughts on this, I think it's a great approach. And somebody always says, you know, but what happens when they leave? Yes. What happens when they leave? First of all, there's the old adage, right? What if I train them and they leave? What if you don't and they stay? Mm-hmm. But there's the flip side to that. So you're worried about being known as the people who create superstars. Mm-hmm. That's never going to be a problem. That means you'll have people standing outside your door waiting to get in,
right?
And maybe they'll take it cheaper at the jump. And then what happens is you can figure out who your real superstars are. Trust me, you can find ways to retain them. And then a lot of people, they're going to work with you for a year. Thanks for the memories. Punch out. Go get good money. And if you train them well, you've built a legacy and you've transformed the industry. I think so. This whole, oh, what if I, no, but with limited exception, point me to the companies that have really figured out onboarding, really figured out security training, really figured out the skill sets that somebody needs in order to solve these problems. They don't have it. If you don't have that stuff in place and you're not sure who you're hiring for and what role they're going to be in and how they're going to contribute value, right? That contribution margin of the role, not the person. What are you hiring for exactly?
I think what you're saying is, Michael, is it comes down to leadership and communication.
Yeah,
employer,
I mean, I think
from the employer side, right? They have to be a leader in the community. They have
training.
To communicate well and train. Yeah, and be a part of the solution, not part of the problem.
I mean, you and I have looked at tools, right? So we talked today, like the tools that come in and they help you evaluate the tools mm-hmm. that you have. These cyber ranges and portable cyber ranges and simulations. I mean, so what you're telling me now is I could take somebody who's rudimentally interested and I can test them out in like a day or two and see if they got it or not. And if they're fired up, I can take them and train them in a period of 4 to 6 weeks. They're yes. solid.
Funny story about
that. That's awesome.
Sam was helping organizing the conference, and someone from an air in the National Guard, some military
yeah.
unit had they were like, well, we want to bring the live fire range. And Sam was like, these are students. We can't have firearms there. What are they talking about? No, it was what you were talking about. It was the live fire cyber range.
The National Guard, I've been privileged to attend some of their cyber shield style exercises. Paul, mm-hmm. you know what's great about it? The one I went to, and I'll make this real quick. So they had your red teams, they had your blue teams. And then they had industry partners that were part of it. Industry partners had to get their legal teams involved. This was freaking awesome because this is the way it would work if we actually needed to engage our guard partners, right? So mm-hmm. the National Guard works a little different than other parts of the military. So this is important if you're in the commercial sector as well. FBI sent people to it, local and federal state police sent people to it so that we had the actual fusion center, and they ran live fire exercises. So then the industry partners were allowed to come in and to participate. So if you got to talk to some of them afterwards and they said, well, I never understood that's how it worked. Mm-hmm. Imagine setting something up like that on a consistent basis and rotating in different legal teams and rotating in different police units and rotating in different whatevers. Paul, there's no better way to learn. There's no better way to show your executives. There's no better way to show the return and point at stuff and ask questions. I came away from that thoroughly impressed, totally jazzed up, probably took 10, 15 pages of handwritten notes. Like on the car ride home, I was so excited. I had to stop, get out of the car, and just write the notes out of my head until I stopped or ran out of ink. So when you then say to me, could we go set up these apprentice programs in our organizations today and turn out higher quality security talent? Absolutely. And I hope it happens. I'm happy to support it. And I think we need more of it. Yeah. It's going to take some leadership and communication. And then of course you got to go find the right training and measure. I mean, there's more to it, but yeah, these are the things that get me fired up.
And the CCDC is a good program for students. Very similar to that as well, which we've talked about before.
Yep.
All right. With that, we can take a short break, come back, talk about startup security news. Stay tuned. Don't go anywhere. Hey, welcome back, everyone. I want to remind everyone to go to itpro.tv/startup security. Check out our fine friends at itpro.tv. Use the discount code SS30. Try it free for 7 days. Get 30% off your monthly membership for the lifetime of your active subscription. And do the supervisor portal. Encourage your employer to purchase a supervisor portal so you and all your fellow coworkers can get access to an awesome library of training. You will be happy that you did that. Provided you can convince your employer. Just tell them that Paul and the gang from Security Weekly sent you. You'll be fine.
There you go. I think that's the right answer.
How about that? So, Michael, lots of really cool startup news this week.
Yeah. Yeah, in fact, let me start by saying every time, right, this is why we bring this up. We'll pull up an article. Oh, IPOs are off. Oh, the tech market's in a slump. Oh, cybersecurity's stop. All right, let's open up Black Duck. Black Duck. I didn't realize they'd been around since 2002, Paul. You and I came across them at a conference just this year, and they hand out little black ducks, ducks. These guys snapped up by Synopsys. $565 million. Now, since 2002, they've taken on $75.5 million in funding, and Arler estimates them at $55 million in revenue. So $565 million sale, depending on how you cut that. I mean, that's good. That's a good price, and that seems like a pretty good exit. What are your thoughts on this?
I thought it was interesting. Synopsys is like listed on Arler as competing with like chip companies and stuff. I'm not sure exactly what Synopsys does, to be quite honest with you. Do you know what they do?
I tried wrapping my head around it as well, and it really didn't make a lot of sense sense to me.
Accelerate innovation in the global electronics market. Computer integrated systems design company.
I think so.
Go ahead, Michael.
Well, no, yours first, and then maybe I'll sound... Maybe I'll stop because you'll be more intelligent.
No, I don't know about that. But I can see that if Synopsys is helping companies design electronics and there's a software aspect to it, that Black Duck would play very nicely in that, that as you design a system and the software that goes in that system, you can make sure it doesn't have vulnerabilities, especially ones that are known, because IoT devices or embedded computers, as we used to call them, tend to borrow a lot of libraries from...
there you go.
You know, share a lot of libraries. And so if that one's vulnerable, you can make sure it's not in, in the chain. But to pay $500+ million for a company that maybe you're just going to integrate into your offering, I'm thinking that they're going to leave them selling in the enterprise after I saw the sale price. It wasn't a closeout sale. I mean, so, like, if they got a bargain, I mean, they might do both, right? But they're, I, they're, but not going to take
does,
out.
Yeah, that
the
definitely does not feel like that was an acqui-hire. That doesn't feel like it was a fire sale or things were bad for them. But, you know, what's interesting is, it, so I'm looking at this Xconomy article, and it says, all right, founded in 1986, Synopsys helps design and test silicon chips and also works in application security testing. But one of the things that I think is interesting, and I think what you hit on is exactly the direction I was going to go, we're starting to see now where the chip manufacturers, I mean, we just talked about the IoT platform that ARM's advancing, that they kind of look at it now and they go, oh, there's got to be a different way to do it. Oh, and you know what? In fact, if you think back, this, we covered this on Hack Naked this week. We're going to not just give you the models and we'll give you the code. We'll give you the threat models and analysis on it. We'll give you the best practices. We're going to show you how to do it better. So I could see now a play where if you're helping people do chip design, the chips now, if you think about this, I mean, we talked, and you and I have had lots of great conversations with people who looked at stuff that in the 70s and 80s they wanted to do, but our processor power, our memory, our network speeds, they just weren't there. A lot of stuff in the late 90s, when I got started in this, that was, it sounded good. We tried it, but the reality is it didn't work well. And now, 20 years later, 25 years later, we're seeing that work. Why? What's changed? I can offload a bunch of different stuff on the chip. I can do all these different things. We're building, like, the Apple's got the Enclave. And then I've already forgot what Intel's is called, but everybody's got, like, these different types of processors and coprocessors and security modules and all sorts of other stuff on it. So if you're in the business of being able to test that and to automate that testing and to speed that to market, that's really cool. And, you know, for a company that generated $2.5 billion of revenue, or almost $2.5 billion of revenue, $565 million, I mean, it's a big price. But this might see a big chunk of their business. So I'm going to be really curious, as you pointed out, does this now move them into the enterprise play? Or does this potentially give them an advantage in the embedded devices now called the IoT market? So I think it's interesting, but it's a successful exit. So here's a company that they've been around since 2002. We talk about category kings in that book. They talk about successful exits are typically within the 6 to 10-year range. Well, we're at the 15-year range. But, man, it looks good across the board for them.
Mm-hmm. WatchGuard makes an IPO. That's cool.
Remember when their box used to be, they had the black, they were red. They came, like, WatchGuard was different because their boxes, instead of just being blinky lights, they were red cases.
Right.
So I thought this was interesting because it was WatchGuard falls for the IPO. So I went, I looked at it, I went, okay, so I get that WatchGuard's still around, but wait, they're filing for an IPO now? Well, they did. They filed for an IPO. They IPO'd in 1999, which kind of matched. It wasn't like I tracked it and I went, didn't they IPO before? But I was like, that seems weird. They were delisted in 2006. So this is essentially an IPO again. Mm-hmm. Now, what's interesting then is that when you go dig into it, they've got private equity money in it. So one of the things we talk about a lot is that you can have venture capital and private equity. You can have both. There's now the ICOs, the initial coin offerings. There's all sorts of other strategies, and that's what we always keep looking at here. So, you know what, don't call it a comeback, but WatchGuard is putting themselves back on the market with an IPO, and they're doing a unified threat management stuff. I've always got the sense that they're kind of an SMB play, but this is a space I know for a while you looked at. Is that about right?
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think some of the SMB are probably trying to dabble in what I'm hearing this year being called the small enterprise, right? And I think that can take many shapes and forms as well.
That's interesting. That just feels like somebody in marketing trying to confuse me, but maybe there's merit to it. Do you
maybe
like it?
Something between, maybe there's something between mid-market and enterprise. They call it small enterprise. I think it's just further market segmentation.
Yeah, and that's not necessarily bad.
Because it lets them grow their product line, but they don't have to grow their product line to put it, you know, drop it in and compete with Cisco in a Fortune 1000 or Fortune 2000.
Yep.
they can scale it back and say, well, it's a small enterprise, which I don't think it's marketing. I like that strategy.
Okay. Now that you're talking it through with me, so what you're saying is I need enterprise grade management and enterprise grade application, but I'm not a Fortune 2000, so I don't need all the bells and whistles, everything else. It needs to be able to work. Mm-hmm. But I'm also, you're probably not my sole source provider. So I might not have my 50 vendors. I might have 5 to 10. You need to play nice. And you need to be a part of my solution because I'm getting there, baby, growing bigger. I like it. SailPoint, $100 million IPO, or at least that's what they've listed. They've taken on roughly $26 million in funding since 2005. So here we are, 12 years later. If they are not the category king, they are certainly up there. I know CyberArk is a competitor. CyberArk is definitely up there. If they're not the category king, somebody is. When we look at identity, there's a lot in as we talk with Jonathan Sander a lot. If he's listening today, he's probably just cringing at what I just said. Seriously, take that webinar. He's one of the smartest people I've ever met. Identity is a big field. Here's the point: it's hot, and it's going to stay hot. So congratulations to SailPoint for the plans for their IPO, and we're going to watch how that goes. I think what bodes well for them, Forescout. So we talked about them a couple weeks ago, and on their first day of trading, they were up, I think it was about 16%. So that's really good. I mean, you'll see a lot of people, like recently Snap, right? They ended down in trading, and that basically says, look, you overpriced it. You didn't do as well as you wanted. Forescout actually did really well. They raised about $116 million. They sold 5.3 million shares. But here's the quote that I pulled because I thought it was really interesting. Forescout had $167 million in sales last year compared to $126 million for 2015. That's great. But losses grew to $75 million last year, up from $27 million in 2015. So your losses basically tripled.
Losses as in they lost customers didn't resign?
Well, typically what that means is if you're looking at your losses, it might be that you had new liabilities. Like there's a lot of things that come into the losses. And to be fair, I didn't dig into this, and I could have. So I'm now slightly surprised
they
didn't.
Now, if they're public now, we have all the information available to us, right?
Yeah. And they had to disclose that. Now, remember, they did kind of like a clandestine IPO. There's a way that they were able to do it both quicker and a little bit quieter. Mm-hmm. But if your losses are growing, what that means is that you're not making as much money. So like typically what'll happen is they'll say, look at that. We jumped our revenue up by not quite 50%, like 40%. But then you have to say, okay, well, and what kind of losses? So maybe, Paul, when we look at the contribution margin, they were flying a bigger sales team, or they were making a better deal. So you may find that actually customers renewed, but they knew they were getting ready for an IPO, so they offered them a sweetheart deal. Yeah. And I'm not knocking Forescout on this, but this is something I see a lot in these big vendors, is that they walk in and they start out, it's kind of like buying an RV or a car. You're not going to pay MSRP. So I come in and I say, look, we sell you this, it's $100 a seat, but I can drop it to 60. That's your opening position. By the way, if you do that, please stop. Just have some value. Go in. I mean, why was it priced at 100? Like, let's stop the games. But that's what, like, when I'm reading this, you increase your sales by 40%, but you tripled. Your losses grew by 300%. Okay. That tells me that you were getting ready. You were making all this stuff work. Now, here's the thing that I think is interesting. We are on a path towards profitability, said the CEO. One of the things I have learned looking at this is that there are certain models where you're doing subscription-based work, and Forescout's trying to position itself as an Internet of Things security company, it is quite possible that they've made a series of investments and one-time charges and a bunch of capital costs to launch new services or reconfigure the way that they do stuff.
If that pivot to
cost.
Yeah. But is that pivot to IoT on the flip side of that, Michael? Is that just their changing their messaging? Their technology is still the same, but their messaging is just saying IoT. Because it's still NAC, dude. Like, it's still authenticating devices in the network. They're just like, oh, when your IoT stuff comes on the network, we can help you with that too. And they didn't really have to make a huge technology investment to claim in their messaging that we help with IoT. And oh, by the way, I'm seeing this trend of companies that are saying they're in one space and pivoting now into IoT. I think it's risky. I think there are players out there that will do it and do it very well. But I think some are going to fail because they jumped on the IoT bandwagon.
Yeah,
I don't think Forescout's going to fail.
And I'm going to be really curious to see where it goes. And we are going to now pay attention to how they continue to do and where it goes. Look, as you and I talk about all the time, you know, we're an IoT security company. Cool. What problem do you solve? IoT security. I don't even know what that means.
What is that?
Right. So we'll see where it goes. All right. Booz Allen, they acquired Morphic. Morphic cybersecurity platform offers managed detection, incident response, threat intelligence, reverse engineering for enterprises. On record, they got about $10 million in funding. That was just the Series A, September 2015. Now, something, I know you've got some thoughts on this. It was undisclosed. That typically, to me, signals maybe not as good an exit as everybody wanted. And the general guidance is your funding round should last you 2 years. Doesn't always, right? Mm-hmm. And there's a number of cases where very good reasons why it doesn't. And there's a number of very bad reasons why it doesn't. And there's just a bunch of stuff. There's no science to this. Actually, there probably is. But so here we are 2 years later. Basically, if they did it right, they're about to run out of cash. So either they get acquired, they get another round. They got acquired, but nobody wanted to talk about the deals. And they got acquired by a pretty large government contractor.
Yeah.
Thoughts?
Well, so what I think is interesting about this one, and here's my crazy theory, Michael, which I think is kind of fun. And I don't mean any harm, or I'm not knocking either of these two companies, because they, in all likelihood, could be really awesome companies. I thought it was interesting that a services company took $10 million in funding. Everything I read, Morphic was a services company, which I thought was interesting. That's pretty risky, taking $10 million if you're, I mean, so you got to have some good things in the pipeline to recoup that investment for your investor. And one of the things that they did, so they took their Series A in September 2015. In around the same time, about a year later in 2016, they got officially approved as an NSA contractor, at which time I'm thinking they started competing with Booz Allen. A year after that, Booz Allen goes, you know what, we're just going to buy you.
Yep.
That was just my take on it, just from reading the, you know, the news that surrounds it. It very well could have happened completely different. It could have been a very, even though it was undisclosed, Michael, it could have been a great deal for both parties, right? They could have been working together.
Yeah, and that's something we talked about.
They're both NSA contractors. Yeah. Maybe they were working together on stuff, and they're just like, hey, you know what? It makes sense to sell.
And I think it's a really good point, because when you look at the way that, right, and you've clearly been exposed to it, there's primes, there's subprimes. It's a myriad of stuff. Then to be able to work at the agency and get stuff done there. I mean, obviously, we've got friends of the family here that have a lot more experience in that than you and I do. Lots of neat stuff happening there. And so, yes, I think what you laid out makes sense. And by the way, there are a lot of times it makes sense not to disclose the terms,
right?
Because there's other companies. You don't want them to know what you're doing, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Totally makes sense. I'm still going to stick with, if it's undisclosed, it's probably more of a, hey, how about we just all work together? And it could be a good deal for everybody,
right?
But it didn't create any new value. All right. Biologic. All right. So I don't know if you had a chance to take a look at this yet. I'm going to just go out and say it. So, is it Intezer? Is that how you would say that?
Intezer is how I
Israeli,
would say it.
Israeli startup, $8 million Series A. Cybersecurity company specializes in offering biological immune system-based malware analysis and detection to address threats. Feels a lot like our good friends at Minerva to a certain extent.
Mm-hmm.
At least based on that description. And I went to their website and it was kind of like, oh, that's interesting. What they're basically saying, if I got it right, was we're going to help you with malware analysis and detection, but we're going to do it more like an immune system. So we're going to learn from biology, and we're going to apply it to what we're doing here.
Which I hate that analogy for so many reasons. Anyway,
I think it opens you up to a lot of derision and a lot of confusion. I think you've got to tell that story really tight to make it work.
Mm-hmm.
And when I looked over their website, I went, but an $8 million Series A is not laughable. That is a big ask. So either... Right? And they had a $2 million seed round. So either they've got some big pockets and they're doing some pretty awesome stuff and they're going to hit it hard, or I don't actually even know the or. That's interesting to me. So no B4, $30 million Series B round. I tend not to talk very often about security awareness companies. If you call it security awareness training, you make me want to bash my head into a wall. There's awareness and there's training. You can have security awareness and you can have security training. Security awareness training would be training me to be how to be. I don't even like. I just it's every time I bring this up, somebody wants to sit me down and say, "But Michael, that's just how our industry is." Right. This is why nobody pays attention to it, except for $30 million Series B. So they've been in business for a long time. They're not new. Stu's been doing this for a while. Mm-hmm. I know some of the folks on this team I really respect. So I like the people. $8 million Series A. So that's a huge open. Then they did a $5.2 million equity round about a year later in February of 2017. And they just added $30 million in a Series B. That's a huge Series B, and typically in a Series B, you're ending your early stage round of funding. So that, what that means is your product market fit should about be right. You got your Yep. team in place, you understand how you're going to market, you understand what you're selling, and you're ready to get into growth mode. And based on how long they've been around and what they're doing, I mean, I probably just make a phone call or two, and maybe we'll try to follow up on this. My take on this is that's a pretty big round because I feel that they're mature enough that they're probably moving into growth mode. Like that almost feels like a growth mode round, not a, I think we're going to get it figured out.
Despite not separating awareness and training, which is all likelihood just a marketing and messaging thing, the problem they solve and the solution is pretty straightforward, right? It's a problem that every enterprise, every business has. My users get tricked with email phishing attacks. We can help with that problem. And everyone has that problem. Everyone needs to solve that problem. It's a growing problem today. Hence, I think that moving into growth mode and taking $30 million Series B makes total sense. If their solution works, and obviously it must, they must have a pretty good customer base to jump to that Series B.
Yeah, and so definitely people to pay attention to. Last of the busy week, Recorded Future, $25 million Series E. So this is interesting. So that's a big, I mean, when you're into your Series E, I mean, your growth stage, like that basically means you got it dialed in, baby. You're growing and you're looking for some sort of an exit. Either you're going to pop and get an IPO, right? So by the way, SailPoint only took on $26 million of funding over the last 12 years, and they just filed for a $100 million IPO. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, Recorded Future took on $25 million of Series E. That's not huge for a growth mode. I mean, if you go look at some of these, you know, tech unicorns, their Series E are like $100 million rounds. $25 million, it's not sneezable. That's a good chunk of change. But since 2009, they've only raised $57.9 million. So here's what I like about this that makes them still ripe for an acquisition. They did not price themselves out of a marketplace. Right. I didn't look at and I didn't try to calculate out any of the valuations on the company. And I wish I was connected enough I could make a couple phone calls and tell us, but we're not there yet. Give us another year. The show will be your go-to resource for that. But I think it's interesting. I think it's one of these fields where you talk about threat intelligence, and now you're talking about, well, is it threat intelligence or is it risk intelligence? And what does it mean to be intelligence? And how does it help an operator? And is it helping our SOCs? Recorded Future is one of the companies that's kind of hanging in there. We've talked about some others that it's kind of like, so are you a threat intel company or are you an endpoint company or are you a SOC automation company or are you or whatever else?
I think they're pivoting outside of the threat intelligence market for sure. And they've got some interesting technology that I saw at Black Hat that makes me think they put a lot into research and development, and could be that the E round, a lot of that's going to go to sales and marketing to push them into the to getting a larger market share.
Into that next jump. Yep. Yep. I just tell you what, they were very kind about a year ago. They took me through a demo and I came away thoroughly impressed.
Yeah, me too.
And they're the folks on that deep web stuff. And so I said, well, here. And what I really liked was the folks that I talked to, they were able to tell me really quickly the problem that they solved. And they said, here, let me show you a demo. Let me give you an account. Let me walk you through it. And, you know, it was one of those things where I went, wow, I could totally see how the more you understood your business, the more you could set this up and really drag some stuff through it. So, I mean, I was kind of impressed with what I saw. So congratulations to them. I mean, everybody here, I mean, you know, I think you and I are going to tell it like it is always. It's in our DNA. But, you know, this represents a lot of good stuff happening in the security industry. Mm-hmm. And we just talked about all the good things that can happen in the security community. In terms of our updates and where we're heading, I've been so excited I couldn't stop it. So the new workshop is launched, and I've gone out and we started working on folks a couple times. You know, here's the interesting thing, Paul. We've talked consistently now for the last year and a half. When we look at these stories and we keep saying to people, pick one thing, pick your niche, pick your one thing, get really good at it. I think people have heard me talk before about the distinction between knowing of something and actually knowing it. It's that, oh, I'm familiar with that versus having the competence in it. I'm guilty of that too, because I've known for the better part of a decade, 12 years, 15 years, the sooner you find a niche and get really good at it, the better everything will be around it. And I've always said, yeah, I totally want to do that. Oh, but I'm also going to do this and this and this and this. But you're like, I'll pretend that they're all connected. What's happened is people have asked me for a way to make it work. And without getting too deep into it for here, but if anybody's interested, I'm happy to talk to them. I figured out a way, Paul, to get people invited ahead of time. And when we do it, it's called a workshop. It's not training. We're actually working through an issue. Now, do we do training? Of course. I interleave the training. I can give the training to people ahead of time so they can read it, they can see it, they can touch it, they can taste it, they can try it. So when we're together and we're working through it, we're really helping them solve a problem, but using some different mental models and using some different systems and using the Straight Talk framework approach to solve the value proposition. We call it identifying the value proposition. And what I looked at were the biggest challenges that I came up with teams over the last 2 or 3 years. But here's what I'm finding, Paul. I'm getting more excited, not less. And the more I get done with it, the more I see, like, there's so much more that we can do with just this one workshop. The more I talk about it, the more people get excited about it. The easier it is to explain to them the things that we're putting together. The easier it is to do the prep work. The easier it is to go through it. And here's the beauty. No two workshops are the same because you're going to have a different team. Even if you have the same team, you're going to have a different problem. Your understanding is going to be different. Paul, I'm on fire. Like, I'm so excited about it. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, that carries over. So I've talked to a number of people who I talked to over the summer, and they said, wow, this makes so much more sense. Okay, so let me get something scheduled with you. I get it now. I understand it now. You sound so excited about it, Michael. This is going to be great. But then you go and you work with the teams, and it is great. Watching people solve problems and figure stuff out and realize why they got stuck. Mm-hmm. Oh, so you ask me how I'm doing. I'm good. Now, that came at the – I've been promising everybody updates to the Straight Talk framework. Okay, that's not done yet. And I've been promising people updates to the website. And on the website, we're going to have a new resource on identifying the value proposition. Now, that's done, except for the website's not done. I've been using that in the workshop, getting great feedback on it. So I'm going to take some of those pieces. We're going to put them on the website. Anybody shortly will be able to sign up for that. Some of you have sent me really polite messages saying, hey, you took down the sign up and the Straight Talk stuff. Yes, it's all coming back. Chances are, so I got a workshop next week. Week after that, so between there and like around Thanksgiving timeframe, if you're here in the U.S., basically November, looking to do the website, and between November end of the year, work on getting an updated version of the Straight Talk framework together. But we'll have the value prop stuff done first, and then I'm really just, you know, somebody asked me the other day, Paul, what are the ways to work with you? And classically, you know, you would say, well, I could do speaking and training, and I could do consulting, and we could do coaching and whatever else. Yeah, I'm pretty much down to this workshop is the right way to do it. And once you've had that experience with me, I have an executive coaching program for both individuals and teams, and we have some different advisory services we can offer people. It really turns out, though, that the teams that go through this just a day with me, totally different experience. So I feel like when you say, like, how's our journey? Paul, it's coming together. It's and I'm getting time now to focus on it deeply. So I'm seeing the connections. I mean, I have so much that I want to write about, so much I want to do, so much I want to explore. And of course, it's all going to benefit what we're doing here. So my journey is, I'm on a good place and I'm on a good roll. So I'm enjoying it. How about you, man?
Things are going really well. We've got some awesome conversations that are happening that I can't really disclose publicly yet. But, you know, it ties to just constantly working on our MVP messaging, go-to-market strategy, and how that's evolving and changing over time, or not. And really, that's what it comes down to. So I will provide more details as they become available. How about that?
I like it. It's you're teasing us.
That's right. So it's a tease.
I'm going to have to stay tuned.
Yeah,
like
and you'll be here in studio next week.
I was wondering if we were going to tell people or not, but yes,
so
my
excited.
Workshop is in Boston, and so we've worked it out. I'm going to head there, and I think people might even get a chance to see me on a couple shows. I'm going to get back to Security Weekly because I won't have to worry about the kids.
And it's going to be awesome. You're going to be live. You'll be
in
live
studio.
Here in the studio for the first time. We've never
first
done
time.
A live podcast together.
We have not.
In
so it's
room.
It's going to
be awesome.
A week of first. It's gonna be a good week. I'm excited. I'm looking forward to it. And that's going to give us a chance too, you know, because you and I always joke, people always say, oh, you guys, you must talk to each other all the time. Not as much as we want, but next week we're going to get some time and we've got a bunch of ideas.
Are you going to smoke
cigars? Sometimes.
Are you going to smoke cigars when you come here? Are we both going to be having a cigar during Startup Security Weekend?
Yeah.
That's going to be epic.
It's been a while.
That's going to be
epic. You have to help me pace myself.
I will. I'm your coach in the cigar smoking. extravaganza Perfect. That
well,
will happen.
Well, then, yeah, I'm on board. So, yeah, we're going to brainstorm some ideas for next year.
You'll be fine as long as you don't drink an entire bottle of wine, like apparently you're known for now or something.
I may have not paced myself very well the other day on an empty stomach and reminded myself that in your 40s, you don't feel like you're in your 20s.
It hurts. Well, thank you, everyone, for listening and watching this edition of Startup Security Weekly. See you next week, where we'll both be live in studio. So stay tuned.